I want to begin by introducing next session speaker, who is Bill Breeden, a Unitarian Universalist pastor, retired from Bloomington, Indiana, and as he says, the only person arrested, the only person to serve jail time for the Iran-Contra scandal. And he'll be joining us next week, or 2 weeks from now. When we set this up, we neglected to realize that two of our sessions were on holidays, Mother's Day and Memorial Day, but we're going to pretend they don't exist and move forward. Today I want to talk about the pursuit of happiness. And when I first came across that phrase, I came across it because my father was active in politics, which began when I was just a kid, so my brothers and I were drafted into helping him, even though Dad was a Republican, and I was starting to see things from the Democrats' point of view because Richard Nixon was such a doofus and kind of reminded me of the Penguin on the old Batman TV show. But I remember most of all, as was the case then in Danville, and I'm sure still is in many small towns, how we would go up to the courthouse to watch the poll results phoned in from the far-flung metropolises of Amo and Cartersburg and hanging on the edge of our seats until the vote came in from North Salem, which could just tip everything one way or the other. And then watching Russ Lawson, who was the head of the County Highway Department, climb the ladder there in the rotunda of the courthouse and hang the numbers up, the poll results. The Republicans, like now, would always win. It was always just a slaughter. They would win by huge margins. It was like watching Saturday morning wrestling on television. When you just knew that Baron von Raschke was going to beat Dick the Bruiser through some nefarious manipulation when the referee wasn't watching. So I developed a certain sympathy for the underdog, which persists to this day. But I would watch Russ Lawson climb up and down that ladder until I was bored, and then would wander across the rotunda and read the Declaration of Independence that hung on the wall. When I was little, my brother Glenn told me that it was the real Declaration of Independence, the actual one which the federal government kept in Danville, hidden in plain view to fool potential thieves. And I believed him. It made perfect sense to my seven-year-old mind. I would stand there and read it. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And it was always that last phrase that always intrigued me, the pursuit of happiness. What was that about? I knew what life and liberty were, but what was the pursuit of happiness? What was that? I noticed it wasn't a guarantee of happiness, just that one could pursue it. A man named John Locke, he was an English philosopher and is sometimes referred to as the father of liberalism. He was the first one to coin the phrase, the pursuit of happiness, which Thomas Jefferson then appropriated for the Declaration of Independence. When Locke used that term, he not only meant the pursuit of pleasure, I mean, he meant at least that, as we often understand the word happy, but Locke believed, as did Jefferson, that the pursuit of happiness meant having the freedom to make decisions that result in the best possible life for us. Men and women must be free to make the decisions and choices that lead to the best life, the happiest life they can imagine. provided, of course, their happiness does not impinge upon the happiness of others. But that's where your pursuit ended, when it began impinging on someone else's chances for a happy life. Of all the lofty ideals contained in our founding documents, no one principle, it seems to me, has been so ignored as the pursuit of happiness. First, let's explore what it wasn't. The founders weren't talking about happiness as a subjective emotional state, the way I might say eating ice cream makes me happy. That's not what they meant. Nor did they equate happiness with mere wealth. Rather, they believed happiness happened when people achieved prosperity, and their prosperity was undergirded by virtue and buttressed by knowledge. So there were three components: sufficient prosperity, so that you weren't in want, a life of virtue, and the attainment of knowledge. Those three things were the pillars of what they meant when they talked about happiness. So one had access to wealth, one had a life of virtue, and one was forever in a state of the acquisition of knowledge, that one was always being educated. I suppose if a poll were taken today asking modern Americans to define the characteristics that make for human happiness, people would talk about having enough money, or maybe on Mother's Day they would talk about family relationships, others might speak about meaningful employment, having a vocation that they enjoyed, that they found meaningful. Some might mention being part of a community. Some might mention a relationship with God. But I don't think many of us would identify wealth, virtue, and the attainment of knowledge as the necessary components of human happiness. The path to human happiness isn't the same today as it was then. I always feel like Marco Rubio when I take a drink during a speech. Another shift in our understanding centers on the word pursuit, what that meant to our ancestors and what it means to us. Today we're likely to interpret the word pursue as something we might strive after, something we might chase after or hunt for, but pursuit also has a less common meaning, which was the predominant meaning when the Declaration was written, and this had to do with one pursuing a vocation. Pursuing a vocation. So one could talk about the pursuit of medicine, for instance, or the pursuit of law. A pursuit was something one engaged in. Therefore, to speak of the pursuit of happiness was meant to engage in the vocation of happiness, which is to say to enjoy prosperity while living virtuously and growing in knowledge. There was one problem with that ideal, and that was our founders' unwillingness to extend the possibility of happiness to women and people of color. It was a pretty big mistake. Ironically, then, having denied them that pursuit, to simultaneously argue that they were unsuited by virtue of their gender and race for that pursuit. Now think about that. It punished them for failing to achieve a standard the founders socially and legally forbid them from attaining. So they set up this barrier to it. So that was one problem. But there was another problem, which has been a problem since our earliest days. While much time and thought has been given and devoted to exploring the parameters of life and liberty, little consideration has been given to our legal and social structures and how they add to or subtract from our happiness. In fact, I can't ever recall any politician, and I follow politics pretty closely, I can't ever recall any lawmaker when discussing the merits of a bill with his or her peers ever asking, what effect will this law have on our pursuit of happiness? This, despite the Declaration's insistence that the pursuit of happiness is an unalienable right, a right not able to be taken away or denied, a right central to our lives as human beings. And if we were to ask this question, think of the difference it would make. If our right to pursue happiness were a consideration, we would pass laws that protect us from gun violence, since being shot is a proven hindrance to the pursuit of happiness. We know this. This is a fact. I've never met anyone bleeding to death from a gunshot wound who seemed happy about the matter. If our right to pursue happiness were a priority, we would institute a system of health care available to all with no regard for one's employment or ability to pay. For it is difficult to be happy when one's body is crippled by pain or illness. If our right to pursue happiness were a priority, we would spend as much money educating the rural and inner city children of Indiana as we do the children of Carmel and Zionsville. For it is difficult to be happy when one lacks the basic tools to navigate life and achieve prosperity. If our right to pursue happiness were a priority, no one would be kept from voting, and everyone would have an equal say in the election of our leaders, for it is demeaning and unjust that the vote of the rich white man outweighs the vote of the person of color. If our right to pursue happiness were a priority, higher education would be determined by one's ability to learn, not one's ability to pay. For it is demoralizing to leave college encumbered by the weight of crippling debt. If our right to pursue happiness were a priority, those who worked hard would receive a fair and living wage for their efforts. For it is embarrassing to rise day after day, month after month, year after year, to work all day long, and at the end of a life, still have nothing to show for it, no retirement to cushion your final years, no hint of rest at the end of your labor. It is embarrassing. If our right to pursue happiness were a priority, imprisonment would be used in the rarest of circumstances, and only then to restore a person and not to harm them. For it is emotionally, financially, and spiritually destructive to separate fathers and mothers from their children, spouses from one another, and people from their community when they pose no threat or harm to their family or community. If America were great, which is the theme of this Chautauqua, we would make it possible for its citizens to pursue happiness so they might have the best life possible for themselves. We wouldn't demand the government make us happy. No government owes that to its people, happiness. We wouldn't demand that, but we would insist the government not impede our chances for happiness, our pursuit of happiness, by acting in ways that harm us and others. Here's an analogy. It's a parent analogy. My wife and I have two sons. It was not our job when they were born to make them happy the rest of their lives. That was not our job as parents. That is their responsibility. But it is our job as parents to not or to raise them in such a manner so that happiness was a real possibility for them, to not impede their opportunities for happiness. Similarly, I do not demand that the government make me happy. But because I believe in our inalienable right to pursue happiness, I do expect that government not imperil my pursuit of happiness, so long as my happiness does not jeopardize the happiness of others. Healthy governments cannot accept responsibility for anyone's happiness, mine or yours. We shouldn't want them to. But we can say to government, do not construct a nation that makes our happiness impossible to attain. Just as we can say to parents, though you are not responsible for your children's happiness, you must not parent them in such a way that makes their pursuit of happiness impossible. When is our unalienable right to the pursuit of happiness most in jeopardy? When are we most likely to lose sight of our declaration and what it said was most important? Our happiness is imperiled when a majority runs roughshod over a minority, when the many receive an advantage the few cannot enjoy. Our happiness is imperiled when religious priorities become the sole basis for law, when by force of law, the mandates of the believers are imposed upon the non-believers. Our happiness is imperiled when the wealthy have the ear of the leaders while the voices of the poor are ignored. Our happiness is imperiled when the bulk of our nation's wealth is held by a relative few and the remaining crumbs are scattered among the many. Our health is imperiled. Our happiness is imperiled when our opportunity to advance is predicated on our status and not our ability. And today we are acutely aware that our happiness is imperiled when knowledge is scorned and ignorance is celebrated. Each year, and I think they've been doing this now for since 2011 maybe, the United Nations started what was called a happiness project. Have you seen this? Where they rank each year the happiest nations. It's called the Happiness Project, and one would think since our founding document specifically mentioned happiness, that the United States would rank near the top. But you would be mistaken. The variables considered when assessing a nation's happiness include this. Real GDP, gross domestic product per capita, social support, healthy life expectancy, freedom to make life choices, generosity, and perceptions of corruption. Perceptions of corruption. Does anyone know what the happiest country in the nation is from the last happiness project? Finland. Close. Finland. Finland's ranked the world happiest country. I think Denmark was two. All those Nordic countries. You know, the socialist countries? Yeah. U.S. is ranked 19th and has been falling every year in the Happiness Project list. due to our declining life expectancy, which is a consequence of gun violence, our failing healthcare system, our income disparity, and our high rate of incarceration. As it turns out, we are measurably less free. I find this fascinating because this hymn of freedom is woven in our history, and it's the first thing you ask people, what do you like about America? Well, we're free. Well, not as free as you think. Not as free as you think. We are measurably less free than 18 other nations and plagued by a significant increase in political corruption. In 1906, my grandfather moved from Belgium to America. I said, Grandpa, when he was alive, why did your family move? He said, well, we wanted a happier life. But according to the World Happiness Project, if he had stayed in Belgium, my chances for happiness would have been much higher. In 1972, my family vacationed in Canada. If my parents had stayed there instead of coming home, I would now be living in the ninth happiest nation in the world. Years ago, it was common to see people of faith wearing bracelets with the letters WWJD printed on it. First, I thought it meant who wants jelly donuts. And then someone said, no, it means what would Jesus do? If I were to make a new bracelet, I would have the letters WWFD printed on it. What would Finland do? Because it's obvious that Finns have attained what we have failed to achieve, and that is a nation whose values, laws, and social structures have a profound and positive effect on human happiness. To that end, I unselfishly offer to send our president and Congress to live in Finland, expand their knowledge, and consequently multiply our happiness. This is the offer I make. All of these kids in college today go to different countries to learn for a semester. Why can't our government do the same? That's just my thought. So here's the question we must ask. When government impedes our pursuit of happiness, what can we do? We know what our ancestors did, don't we? They overthrew their colonial masters and established a new government. But these are different times, and it's probably not wise to unlimber our muskets and storm the White House and the Capitol. But it is possible to not cooperate in our captivity, and therefore to actively, creatively, and consistently resist all efforts that threaten our pursuit of happiness and the happiness of others. And not just use our energy to resist, but use our energy to create new ways of living together. For example, just as denominations all across America once established institutes of higher learning, mostly during the 1800s, to promote education for its members. In Indiana, you can think about DePaul, you can think about Earlham or Notre Dame. Wouldn't it be interesting to launch a new experiment in higher education, but one people could afford? And I'm thinking particularly of the Berea College model in Kentucky, where every student can attend for free, provided they work at a job that helps the college and their own education. Otherwise, it's a free experience for them. I'm thinking of the Lost River Market and Deli in Paoli, Indiana, where Joanne and I spend our summers, where 1,100 people in a community of 4,500 founded a grocery store featuring locally sourced food, a little restaurant, an arts and music center, after Walmart moved in and decimated local businesses. As a result of their efforts, weekly concerts, art shows, lectures, health fairs, food cooperatives, local organic farms, a home for abused women, and a weekly book sale and giveaway promoting literacy have been launched. When a prominent neo-Nazi and the executive director of the Traditional Workers' Party, Matthew Heimbach, moved to Paoli, the folks at Lost River Deli, while the town council was sitting on its hands doing nothing for fear of offending anybody, the folks at Lost River Deli jumped into action, blanketing the town with signs and billboards that read, "No matter what color your skin, no matter where you are from, no matter what you believe, we are glad you're our neighbor." Failing to garner support, Heimbach left town, the Traditional Workers' Party shattered, and Heimbach underwent federal investigation for his participation in the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. If our pursuit of happiness is an unalienable right, then we cannot and must not wait for the government's cooperation. We must act to promote the pursuit of happiness for us and others. It is not only our right to do so, it is our moral and ethical duty. It is especially our duty to act in those historic moments when our leaders, having lost sight of our founders' vision, have failed to act. For happiness and its pursuit is too great a gift, too precious a treasure to be swept away by the currents of political expediency. Listen to these lines. We hold these truths, we hold them to be self-evident, as plain as the nose on our faces, that all people are created equal. Has there ever been a founding document that starts with such beauty and promise? That we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. They can't be taken from us. They can't be diminished. That among these are life and liberty, and I think the most important of all, our pursuit of happiness. Our pursuit of happiness. Well, if I keep talking, I'm going to start preaching, and I don't want to do that. So Barb will come up and lead us in discussion and reflection.
Do we have two microphones? Okay. So I've been instructed to inform you that you need to wait to speak until you have a microphone, because this is being recorded, so don't say anything. You don't want other people on the internet to hear. But say it clearly into the microphones when you do speak.
And I'll also say, too, with this particular microphone, make sure that you hold it fairly close. It's very, very temperamental. I know last time we lost some of the audio because just tilting it like that, it doesn't pick you up. So you pretty much have to be looking right down the barrel.
There's another definition of pursuit in Samuel Johnson's 1755 dictionary, and that is the act of following with hostile intention is a pursuit. And I wonder if that's going back to Locke and what you were saying is the notion that while we can chase happiness, that maybe there is a frustration that we can never attain it. And I don't want to, you know, pour water on this because I really enjoyed your talk, but I'm wondering if there was a recognition that we should try. We should always try, but maybe it is something not attainable, although the World Happiness Report would indicate clearly it is in some countries.
I think there's evidence that, well, hang on just a second. I think there's evidence that what you say is true. I mean, there's lots of people who get caught up, probably largely due to our extremely effective advertising and thinking buying things will make them happy. And it does for a half an hour or a half a day or maybe even 2 days, but then they're unhappy again and they go buy something else, which isn't good for the environment or anything else.
I have visited Denmark, Norway, and Finland, missed Sweden, and I spend a good part, a chunk of every summer in Canada, and there are many things that those places do that we could do better, but there are many things that deeply offend my sense of freedom. You have to ask the city fathers in Norway to change the color of your front door. There is a list of names you may name your children in much of Europe. And if the name's not on that list, too bad. I find that kind of micromanaging very offensive. And in Canada, the Catholic and Church of England get tax money and have government functions, which also bothers me.
I think that the pursuit of happiness, and whether you're on the right or the left, you probably all would agree that that's right, and that should be the rule. But everybody's definition of happiness is where it breaks down, and willingness to share that happiness with all people.
Now that would be interesting. Let's construct, if we can, a universally agreed upon standard and definition of happiness. What is happiness to you? What does it mean to be happy? Contentment? A sense of fulfillment? What are some other adjectives that you think of when you think of what it means to be happy? Peace? So peace would be a component of happiness?
For me, it's
health.
Health?
For me, it's fulfillment in helping others.
Being fulfilled and helping others? Okay.
Self-determination.
Self-determination? That no one else can determine your life for you, that you are free to determine what and who you will be in this life. Okay? A lack of want, okay. So that you're not constantly anxious about how your needs will be met.
Yeah, so you're not always worried about having enough food. Are you going to be able to take care of your children? It's not that everyone needs to be rich, but I think it's hard to be happy if you're constantly hungry.
Right.
I mean, at a basic level.
Yeah.
Kind of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, food, clothing, shelter, before you can move on to fulfillment of any kind.
Yeah, and that's interesting because my sister spends part of her life every year in Kenya, where she works in Eldoret, helping children with bleeding disorders. So it's a very poor population. And I asked her once, why do you enjoy going there so much? And her first response was, because the people I meet are so happy. And And, you know, I say, well, tell me about these people. And she describes people who walk for days to get to the clinic where she works at, and who, if we had to do that, it would almost be like an apocalyptic scenario to us. And yet it doesn't seem to inhibit their sense of contentment in life. I don't know how to explain that. It just made me acutely aware that our sense of happiness is always culturally rooted, and that what makes happiness, say for me, I don't think Donald Trump would be happy with my life, and I don't think I would be happy with his, because our cultures are so different. Yeah, but the recognition that in a very real sense, any definition of happiness that we have is going to be predicated upon the culture in which we live. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that's been my experience as well, just the relative nature of happiness. My younger brother spent a couple of years in Honduras in the Peace Corps, and then through his education was in, Mexico and El Salvador, Guatemala, Ecuador, and each of these places he's been, I've taken the opportunity to go down and visit him, and I always come home and just talk about how happy everyone is that I met down there, and I guess my brother's probably hand-selecting the people that I'm meeting, the vendors and the co-workers and the co-students and so on. But I always come home, and every time I say, Renee, we've got to get the kids down there, because my kids have everything they could ever want, or I think they've got everything they could ever want. They don't. But when I go down there, I think if my kids had the opportunity to see that culture and the happiness that they can create out of so little from what I see, I'm fascinated by that. I love going down there.
Of course, I have 14 questions, but I have been an educator most of my life, but I'm more sociologist than I am anything when I look at things. And I always tell everybody that will listen that I think putting that box in our living room, and my son is 56, and I remember sitting him in front of the TV to watch Captain Kangaroo, as what sort of began to determine the kind of happiness so many people seek nowadays, because it was Father Knows Best, it was all those perfect homes, Mom stayed home and dusted and cooked and whatever, and Dad went off to work. And I think that grew on into the internet and everything else. And I love good movies, good TV shows as much as everybody else, but I think that changed our culture to a certain extent. Plus, everybody always asks me how I got so liberal, and I say because I lived in the 60s, and I watched Vietnam on TV. So I think that kind of thing, because of my sociology thinking. And the other thing, just to ask you, you said you raised your kids, you know, to pursue, to not impede them. Given what you've done, and I've read enough of your books and listened to you enough, I think, you do so much for your community by your speaking and other things, and now your sister is doing things. What did your parents do that you talk about? Dad was a Baptist and Mom was a Catholic, to raise you all to pursue happiness without impeding you. I'd like to know what you feel that they did.
Well, the main thing I recall about my childhood was the lack of structure. So that my parents, either because they had this great insight about how children should be permitted to structure their own days, or were too lazy to give structure to our lives, I'm not yet sure which one it was, didn't fill our lives with a lot of things. We never had a curfew. We had chores, but it wasn't kind of the millstone around our neck kind of chores that we were forced to do or else. So consequently, we just had a lot of time. and no one looking over our shoulder, making sure something got done correctly. I remember Garrison Keillor telling a story about how when he was young, his father made him a boomerang and then did him a huge service by not teaching him how to throw it. And he said, the event would have been ruined had my father, with his big hand, taken my little hand in his and instructed me on its use. Instead, he sat at his belt sander, made the boomerang, handed it to me, and gruffly said, "Here's something for you, kid. Don't break any windows." And that was the instruction. And I thought when I was listening to that story that that pretty well defined my childhood, that that I was really free to experiment, to do things, to try different things out. And there was also enough Roman Catholic in my mother that helping others became kind of instilled in me. My mother was kind of a Dorothy Day Catholic worker kind of Catholic. And so she just kind of drummed that into us too. Yeah. And they didn't let us inside a lot. We simply were not permitted inside. We had a big yard right on the town was in front of us, the country was in our backyard, and they said, "Go and come home for meals. Do you want to know where we're going to be? Are you going to do something stupid? No, probably not. Well, then why do I need to know where you are?" And off we would go. And it was really a great way to grow up. And it's what we tried to do with our kids. Yeah.
I also grew up in the 60s and was one of those long-haired people that, believed that we should be totally free to do anything we want to do. Well, I've lost my hair, but I don't think I've lost my ideals. However, I want to throw a little fly in the ointment. I do remember when I was probably at the peak of my everybody should be free to do what they want to do phase that I read B.F. Skinner's book, Beyond Freedom and Dignity. And the premise basically was that the human race, the human species, has populated to the point where we really don't have the ability to control ourselves anymore. That we have moved to a point where we've got to, if we're going to survive as a species, we've got to be willing to give up some of those freedoms and give up some of our dignity in order to work as a species together and not further screw up the planet and kill each other. So well, I'll throw a little fly in the ointment here.
Yeah. And I think that's what we mean when we say that when your happiness begins to impinge upon the happiness and possibility for others, then your happiness has gone too far. I would love to see substantive national discussions about that. I read today, the only developed nation in the world that has rejected any kind of standards on plastic manufacture and disposal. We don't have the right to do that, it seems to me, in a global world, that we must enter into conversation about that and must assume responsibility for our part of that. So to just say we're not going to do that, to me, seems a real infringement upon the potential of happiness for others, not only for other people, but for creation itself.
I think where the problem comes in, though, is where you draw the line, where you define it. Do we go as far as, no plastics, and also you can't paint your door certain colors.
Right.
Or you can only name your kids certain names in order to get along better as as a people.
Well, I would probably say this, that the color of your door is your business, but my brother-in-law once worked with a man whose last name was Steele, who named his son Stainless. And I think that's cruel. And so I think government should have the right then, in the presence of profound human stupidity, to say to a parent, no, that is not permissible. We will not let you sentence your child to a life of ridicule by naming them a dreadful name. So I have no problem with. Now, I want the list of acceptable names to be as broad as possible. Daisy, Sunflower, North Star, whatever you want. But don't subject your child to a life of ridicule. That would, because no one else is obviously being an advocate for that child in that moment. So, it's like the old story of the person who had twins and they named them Denise and DeNephew. You know, at what point do you say, that's too much? Yeah, but that seems to be a discussion that we're unwilling to have in this country because of what almost seems to me to be the fetish, I don't know how to say this word. We have a fetish when it comes to freedom and liberty. We don't want any strictures at all imposed upon us, even when there is ample evidence that those freedoms cause great harm to others. And I think this is becoming abundantly clear with our interpretation of the Second Amendment and our interpretation of the role of taxes. That the argument now is, why should I have to pay taxes? Well, because you live in a civilized world, and that's the rent you pay. And that we have to have serious discussions about that. Yeah. We're done. Oh, Ann?
And yet we willingly, it seems, move into neighborhoods where we have neighborhood associations that tell us what color our door can be and how tall our flowers can be and how big our dog can be and so forth and more. And we move voluntarily.
Yeah.
I can't explain it.
Yeah.
I think for me, part of that was the thing I gained from that, although I don't like our houses being so much the same kind of dull colors. But my next-door neighbor can't put three cars in his front yard on blocks either.
Yeah. I guess it would depend on the cars, right?
Well, this has been another wonderful discussion, I think, and the Chautauqua series has been going really well. I hope all of you will come back in 2 weeks. Bill Breeden will be here, and that's going to be a lively time.